Hello, good morning everybody. A very warm welcome to the Shakespeare Centre and to reviewing Shakespearean theatre, the state of the art. I'd like to start with some acknowledgements. Thanks to the Capital Centre, University of Warwick, and to Nottingham Trent University, who have co-organised and sponsored this event with the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust. Please could Paul Prescott and Pete Smith, my co-conference organisers, identify themselves at this point. Paul and Pete, for those of you who don't know them. The Society for Renaissance Studies has also acted as a sponsor. Any conference organiser knows that the lion's share of administration and making the whole thing happen is done quietly behind the scenes. For this we have my colleague Katie Ledwidge to thank. Thanks too to our team of volunteers who will be around to help and be of assistance to all of us. Special mention should also go to the British Shakespeare Association for their encouragement of this conference and their publication of some of its future publication of some of its proceedings. And to our distinguished speakers and panellists, all of whom have given so generously and kindly of their time. We're all of us here because in some way we care passionately about the theatre, and especially the performance of Shakespeare's plays. We're here, I guess, because we have all shared to varying degrees similar feelings on the purchase of our theatre ticket to the next show. I expect I'll enjoy it. I hope it's better than the last one. Will it be as good as the one I saw 5 years ago? And so our quests continue, in the ongoing hope that the next one we backed will prove to be a winner. As critics, we are seeking to convey, are we seeking to convey our approbation? Were you sent hither to praise me, says Olivia to Viola. Are we social commentators, seeking for a production to show what Hamlet calls the very age and body of the time, his form and pressure? And we're here because we care about what we say about the Shakespeare we see, what else gets said about it, and the effect this has. From King Lear, Edgar's speak what we feel, not what we ought to say, might well be a theatre critic's best mantra. Welcome. Theatre directors, actors, theatre practitioners, journalists, online blog experts, Shakespeare scholars, writers, students, teachers, theatre's audience, and Shakespeare enthusiasts. Our speakers and all of you have travelled from all over the world to be here. It's great that you're here, and thank you for your support. It gives me enormous pleasure to introduce Michael Billington, expert theatre reviewer, critic and writer, who, since 1971, has been serving the readers of The Guardian very splendidly. His long and distinguished career spans more than half a century, more now than what he once estimated as 8,000 nights sitting in theatres. His knowledge and experience are reflected in his significant book, State of the Nation, British Theatre since 1945. His reviews are in part characterised by their positivism. A critic who a theatre company, on the whole, would be delighted to welcome to their cast party. In April this year, as part of the International Shakespeare Birthday celebrations here in Stratford, Michael was awarded the prestigious George Pragnell Prize for a career which especially enhances our enjoyment of Shakespeare. And he has just been awarded an honorary doctorate by the University of Warwick. The title of his talk is Reviewing Shakespeare. It opens our conference. Please welcome Michael Billington.
Thank you, Paul, very much indeed for that very generous introduction. I feel very flattered to be asked to open this conference. Obviously, it's a vast topic, reviewing Shakespeare, and in the space of 45 minutes, I can only touch on a few headline issues. But I thought I'd narrow the topic down by asking a series of questions. How has the process of reviewing Shakespeare changed over the centuries? What do those changes reveal about the role of the critic in today's culture? And how have Shakespeare productions themselves changed in modern times? The answer to the first question about Shakespeare depends on how far back you want to go. But most of us would accept that journalistic criticism really starts with William Hazlitt in the early 19th century. Now, Hazlitt was many things: a political journalist, a passionate radical, a champion of the Enlightenment. He was also, from his early days in Shropshire, a constant playgoer, and by a stroke of good fortune became theatre critic of the Morning Chronicle in 1813 at the age of 35. By an even greater stroke of luck, Hazlitt's tenure coincided with the emergence of Edmund Kean. Hazlitt, of course, wrote about other famous players: Kemble, Macready, Mrs. Siddons. But it's through his essays on Kean that you get a sense of the excitement of Shakespearean acting in the early 19th century. And I'll pluck out Hazlitt's review of Kean's Richard III in 1814 to show us how he went to work. He begins his essay, which runs to about 2,000 words, lucky man, with some general observations. Mr. Kean's manner of acting this part has one particular advantage. It is entirely his own, without any traces of imitation of any other actor. He stands upon his own ground, and he stands firm upon it. Hazlitt then goes on to offer an account of the contradictions in Shakespeare's character, many of which are omitted in what he calls the miserable medley acted for Richard III. He then goes on, or gets down, to the nitty-gritty, and describes how Kean played specific scenes. On the eve of battle, I quote, his manner of bidding his friends good night, and his pausing with the point of his sword, drawn slowly backward and forward on the ground before he retires to his tent, received shouts of applause. Best of all is Hazlitt's description of Kean at point of death. He fought like one drunk with wounds, and the attitude in which he stands with his hands stretched out after his sword is taken from him had a preternatural and terrific grandeur, as if his will could not be disarmed, and the very phantoms of his despair had a withering power. Well, anyone who remembers the Olivier film will see the influence of Kean on our own great 20th century actor, particularly that image of the sword being drawn across the ground. But it's worth noting that Hazlitt returned to see Kean's Richard III 6 months later, after the actor had been on a highly profitable Irish tour. And Hazlitt found it over-energetic and shoddily articulated. The second notice ends with an extraordinary admonition to Kean, in which Hazlitt says, a training under Captain Barclay, who was a legendary walker at that time, would do more towards strengthening his mind and body, his fame and fortune, than sharing bumper receipts with Dublin managers or carousing with the whole Irish bar. It is rather as if Benedict Nightingale or Michael Coveney had suggested that the young Peter O'Toole would have been far better off getting to the gym than enjoying late nights in the dirty dark. But what's fascinating about Hazlitt's essay is its exclusive focus on Kean's performance. It hints that the text is a mishmash, but it doesn't mention a single other actor by name. Excuse me, tells us nothing about scenic arrangements, and treats the review as a means of exploring Kean's technique and temperament. Obviously, Hazlitt's review reflects the theatre of its time, but I would argue that the belief that Shakespearean criticism was primarily about acting held sway, with a few notable exceptions, until the middle of the 20th century. Jump from Hazlitt to the end of the 19th century, for instance, and you find C.E. Montagu in the Manchester Guardian, writing one of the great critical essays about Frank Benson as Richard II, a performance seen at Manchester Theatre Royal on a Saturday afternoon in December 1899. Montagu was a great prose stylist, and in the space of at least 3,000 words, again, lucky man, he dwells on the idea of Shakespeare's Richard as a conscious artist. Montagu spends a good third of the notice defining what an artist is. He adorns his review with quotations from Lamb, Balzac, Stevenson, and Flaubert. He also gives us a beautifully poignant description of Benson's performance. He runs out to meet the thought of a lower fall or a new shame, as a man might go to his door to see a sunset or a storm. Montagu also vividly describes how Benson handles the lines, mount, mount, my soul, thy seat is up on high, whilst my gross flesh sinks downward, here to die. Where, says Montagu, Benson half rises from the ground and repeats the last two words with a sudden return of animation and interest, the eager spirit leaping up, that the last flicker before it quite goes out, to seize on this new idea of the death of the body. Now that's great criticism. But again, there is no mention of Bolingbroke, of the look of the production, or of the play's political significance. Montague views Shakespeare through the prism of the actor's performance, and creates a piece of prose that is a reflection of that performance. If Benson is the supreme example of Richard S. Eastley, Montague exemplifies the role of the critic as an artist. That tradition, the critic as artist, lingered on well into the 20th century. The idea that the role of the critic in reviewing Shakespeare was not so much to offer an analysis of the play as an account of a performance. James Agate was very much part of the Montague school, and indeed learned his craft on the Manchester Guardian. There were also subtle differences between Agate and his master. Agate, who wrote for the Sunday Times, had a fund of Mancunian hard-headedness. He wrote with more obvious gusto and less refinement. He also acknowledged that Shakespeare's plays contained more than one character. But read Agate's 8 reviews of Hamlet, written between 1925 and 1939, and reprinted in Reed Chronicles, and you find the dynamic comes from Agate's engagement with the lead actor and his performance. Sometimes he throws off fascinating insights. For instance, he says that we ought to feel that even if there were no ghosts and no murder, Hamlet is still an invincible neurasthenic. Reviewing Gilbert in 1939, he also says very shrewdly that Hamlet should show himself as much intrigued by putrescence, material and moral, as any Baudelaire that was to come hereafter, an area in which he found Gilbert signally wanting. But you read Agate to discover how a new Shakespearean performance fits into a great tradition, and exactly how an actor enriched or defined that tradition. He was also brilliant at describing what an actor did. Agate didn't much like the Olivier 1937 Hamlet, but he describes how at the end of the play scene,